No, so first of all, what this should actually be is the mass of a W boson. If I say that, are you happy? So I'm saying that the electroweak scale has to be much less than one, and I've anticipated what I'm going to say here. That's why this is misleading, so I shouldn't have written it this way. So what I'm saying is we know the mass of the W boson has to be much less than the Planck scale, so it's an electroweak hierarchy problem. And maybe it'll be more clear after I go through. The cosmological constant. Yeah. By the way, I'm not going to solve these problems. I'm going to say nature gave them to me. But it'll be clear when I quit being so abstract. So the real point I wanted people to take away from this talk, I'm going to run through examples, but it's not clear to me. We have only examined what I'm going to say in the case of supersymmetry, but I think that it is actually, in fact, more general. So in particular, what I want to focus on first is this unknown, unstable particle, which I'm calling phi. Again, gravitationally coupled, and its mass is generated at the symmetry breaking. So let me, instead of being so abstract, let me go to a specific example and start being a little bit more concrete. So what I have in mind right now is let's consider the MSSM. Let's consider some additional scalar field. Again, doesn't have to be a scalar field, doesn't have to be a fundamental scalar field, but let's just for now take a singlet in the MSSM. I'm going to focus on the case of gravity mediation, and I'm going to consider the case of neutralino dark matter. So in this case, it will be stable by R parity. Okay, so this is a working example to try to illustrate what I was saying. So the idea is that this scalar field will get a mass at the time of gravitational mediation. So that would be on the order of the gravitino mass. And then the gravitino mass to address the hierarchy problem has to be at the TeV scale. And so that's where I'm coming from on this. Okay, so the point is that minimum that will be generated by supersymmetry breaking effects, which would correspond to here, in the early universe, there's no reason the scalar field should be close to this minimum. We know that gravitational effects and non-perturbative effects would lift this flat direction and push it away from the minimum. Alternatively, there's just no reason that you would necessarily find this field near its minimum. So in the early universe, as we evolve through phase transitions, this field will find its place, find the field displaced from low energy minimum. It will then roll down, oscillate, and once these oscillations begin, which is when the expansion rate is on the order of the mass of the particle I'm talking about, this displacement, or these oscillations, the amplitude, will lead to a form of energy density in the form of these oscillations, and those scale as matter. And since because they scale as matter, this energy stored in the oscillations will grow as a factor of the scale factor compared to radiation density. So I'm assuming that everybody's familiar somewhat with this problem. So again, if you have questions, please ask. And so this growing energy density will lead to this matter-dominated phase we were looking for. Yes?
So if you have a low quantum temperature, I mean that temperature of the universe
makes it. Well, so you have to look at each case individually. But yes, so you can ask whether temperature effects are more important than, say, for example, let's say that the first phase you're interested in was during inflation. And then after inflation, you have the radiation-dominated universe. So at the high scale, the inflation itself will give a mass to this field, which would set up a minimum. And then later, the supersymmetry breaking effects would give it a different minimum. And so the two minima generically would be displaced. Are there any other questions? OK, so we have this displaced scalar field. It's oscillating. Its potential much like reheating at the end of inflation. It scales like matter, so it's growing relative to radiation. However, these particles are coupled gravitationally. So eventually, this condensate of particles will decay. When it decays, it will reheat the universe, much like inflation reheated the universe. Except now the reheating temperature will depend on, again, the mass of this particle. And for a mass of a particle around 10 TeV, this would lead to an MeV reheating temperature, which would be around the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. For masses larger than 10 TeV, this would lead to larger reheating temperatures. For masses smaller, this would lead to problems with BBN. Okay, so what we find is when the decay takes place, this decay will happen, it will produce standard model particles, of course, and it will also produce supersymmetric partners. It would decay democratically. For the Suzy partners, they'll quickly decay down to the lightest Suzy partner, which in this case we're taking to be the neutralino, which will be our dark matter candidate. So the scalar field decays after the oscillation. This matter-dominated phase decays into standard model particles and Suzy partners. These are relativistic, they reheat the universe, they dilute things through entropy production, and they also produce dark matter in the decay. Okay, so what does all this mean for dark matter? Well, if we look at the amount of dark matter compared to the total energy budget in the universe, we had the contribution from thermal dark matter, which did take place during this phase. It was matter dominated, but it's still dark matter formed in the thermal bath. It froze out, and it gave me some initial abundance. However, that abundance will be diluted by a factor of this reheat temperature to the freeze-out temperature of dark matter, which is usually around the GeV scale for every electroweak scale candidate. In addition to that, I just got the production of dark matter from this decay, and that turns out, if you do the calculation, to scale much like the cross-section of the thermal case, except you have this enhancement factor of the freeze-out temperature to the reheat temperature. So what happens, for example, is let's say that we look at the case of a 10 TeV scalar field. It forms this condensate. When it decays, it reheats the universe to the MeV scale via this formula. And the freeze-out temperature of our dark matter candidate will be around the GeV scale. So what that means is this is going to be diluted by a factor of 10 to the minus 9. So this dark matter abundance is now negligible. The thermal abundance has basically been wiped out. However, it will produce this amount of dark matter. So what you see is if I want this non-thermal production of dark matter to agree with observations, then I have this extra factor in this specific case for these specific values of 1,000. So I can have a cross-section that's 1,000 times larger than I would have expected from a thermal production. Now I'll point out this is the extreme case. And in practice, you're going to want the mass of this field to be slightly larger than 10 TeV to agree with BBN. Two questions. Yes.
New dark matter that's being created through the decay is then annihilated, so what's left is dependent.
No, so I'm hiding all kinds of complicated details.
First of all, it's not like a branching ratio.
No, very good, very good. No, very good, very good. So first of all, in the reheat temperature, I'm bearing the decay rate. On top of that, I'm assuming that the amount of dark matter you produce is super critical, meaning that I'm going to produce so much of it, it will quickly annihilate down to exactly what you just said.
Okay.
The other case I could have is that it produces less.
And then
it would depend on branching ratios and everything else. That case is actually more interesting as a probe of physics at the high scale. The problem is typically when you run this through models that you have, you find the case where it's super critical.
Okay.
So basically what you have in some sense is a thermal production of dark matter, but at a much lower energy scale.
Absolutely.
And I'm happy to talk about details of this later. I wanted to go on. Did you?
I was actually asked the same question, but since it's asked, I'll another one. What about Gravitinos?
That comes later, too.
Okay.
Yeah, no, so that is obviously model dependent, and it depends on which scenario you're looking at and what dark matter candidates you have, and et cetera, as you know. But Gravitinos are certainly important. I'll come back to that in a bit. Okay, so the point is that we have, in this non-thermal scenario, the scenario I put up before, we actually have two sources of dark matter, and depending on what the parameters in this model are, determines whether you would have this contribution or this contribution. So what's interesting from the phenomenological point of view is that given this possibility of the non-thermal production, we have this window on the cross-section, which is still near the electroweak scale, so we haven't ruined the so-called WIMP miracle, but we now have not just this possibility, but we can have the particles interacting with much stronger strengths, and of course that will have impact on what observations we see. In addition to this, typically when you look at the case we're looking at, which is neutralino from MSSM plus a singlet, the candidate you would be interested in will be a primarily Beano-like neutralino, which is a specific mixture of Gaugenos that you need to get this cross-section. What this implicitly means is that because you can have this larger cross-section, you can have more complicated structure in your neutralino sector, you can have different parts of the MSSM parameter space that become relevant, and for people that don't know what I'm talking about, it's not important. The point is that you can have different candidates and different structure in the particle physics model. Okay, so this is the picture that we now have. We have inflation, we have reheating, then we have this matter-dominated phase, and in the extreme case I ran through, you would have reheating right before BBN. This window, of course, can change. You could have this higher or lower. The point is it would be a different scenario than the thermal scenario. So as a phenomenological model, I just want to take this as it is. We have this possibility of the cross-section being between what we normally expect from the thermal case, and then something strong, more strongly interacting. The point is, we'll have implications, of course, for direct detection, indirect detection, colliders, probes, and cosmology. And I just want to sample each one of these, and then I'm happy to talk about them afterwards. Okay, so yes?
I would like to understand a little better exactly what assumptions you put in to get this range, because normally I would think that a man-dominant era freeze-out would push me towards smaller values of sigma b, because I want to freeze out earlier so I create more, and then it gets diluted away through reheating. And you're really looking more in this, like you said, supercritical regime where sigma b is pushed higher. So what exactly are you assuming that's keeping me from going below 10 to the minus 26?
So there's two constraints. The lower constraint on the mass, which is around, again, these are estimates, around 10 TeV. The reason I have to have the mass of the scalar field above 10 TeV is because otherwise I would not reheat before BBN.
Okay.
So that's the BBN constraint. Then the other constraint at the high end is coming from naturalness. Mainly, I don't know why you would have something with supersymmetry breaking that would have more than 1,000 TeV for the gravitino mass. That's a little more model dependent. Also, if you go above 1,000 TeV, then you would have just thermal production because this effect would not decay in time to affect the production of dark matter. So it would just be thermal production.
I guess I'm saying if it's just pure thermal production, if you didn't have any produced decays, if your phi field, for instance, did not decay to Suzu, then you would expect, in order to get the right level of abundance, you would expect sigma b to be much, much, much smaller.
Oh, no, that's true, and that's not what I'm focusing on here, but that is work that was done in the past. So the point is, your point is, if I had a matter-dominated phase, but I produced dark matter during that time, then I can have also a different cross-section. Absolutely correct. I didn't even mention this. So
okay.
that is correct, yes.
Okay. So this is really coming from the fact that you're assuming that phi is decaying into Suzu particles in a strong enough way that you're in this other regime of second era thermal
energy. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Maybe I'm in your talk, but let's roll time forward 2 years. So we're now running a tangent, running 40 TeV, and we see we can get up to 10 TeV. How am I going to decide whether I can verify this or not?
Okay, I'm about to show you.
You will tell me.
Yes, I'm doing it right now, so I'm going to give you all the, and then you're going to ask me another question, but it's like, yeah.
I'm a little confused. So in this case, all the particles are produced from the phi decay.
Well, in the extreme case where non-thermal dominates, yes. In the other case, you could have some mix between the two.
Uh-huh. But in that case, this phi field is light in the Hubble universe, right? I mean, its mass is much lighter than the Hubble bracket.
I'm going to go through examples later, but the point is that during inflation, it will have a Hubble scale mass, so that could be quite large. Then at late times, it will have a Suzy breaking mass, and there's this regime in between where it basically has no force acting on it.
I was wondering about isotropic fluctuations at this point.
Yes, that's actually a valid concern.
Oh. Mass during inflation to avoid that.
The key for getting around the, this is a little beyond, but quickly answer your question. The way of getting around the isocurvature constraints, which Weinberg actually pointed out a long time ago, but didn't really write a paper about it, was that as long as you have some period where the universe reheats, there is no problem. So, for example, in this reheating phase, in the supercritical case, there is no problem. In the subcritical case, there is a problem, and there's a paper by Jerome Martin where he looks at this. And I'm happy to talk more about that. Okay, so let me quickly run through a sample of what we can say in this non-thermal scenario about observations. So in the direct detection case, I don't have a lot to say about this, except I want to point out one thing. I was free in the non-thermal case to take a purely Wino neutralino. For people that don't know what a purely Wino neutralino is, It's a neutralino that contains no Higgs content whatsoever. So what that means in terms of direct detection is that its direct detection probability, its ability to interact with nucleons, is down here at zero. It doesn't interact with direct detection. So this is a nightmare for people doing direct detection of dark matter. But what it means is that it's a possibility that I could have any mass of the dark matter candidate, and no direct detection would never tell me anything about it. So that's just the one possibility. In practice, you would expect something with maybe a mix of some Wino, some Higgsino, and when you put that mix in, that's actually something Randall Maroy looked at some time ago for other reasons, and then you can put meaningful constraints. So people have looked at that. Again, the point is that when you drop this thermal constraint and drop the constraints like the constraint MSSM, you have a lot of different possibilities, and the story gets much more interesting.
But in the MSSM after Susie Breaking, after the way on mix is with the ACMS, so there is a possibility that it does, I mean, to all orders of perturbation theory, it doesn't. I mean, in the simple MSSM where you look at the masses.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I'm just saying it is in principle possible that you could turn the dial all the way so it's so negligible that you would have no signal. But in practice, I agree with you, in a more realistic model, you would have lots of contamination, and so then you could hope to get some cross-section. Maybe we can talk about that. Okay, so let me quickly say something about indirect detection of dark matter for people that don't know what that is. The idea is that somewhere in our galaxy, especially towards the center, dark matter gets clumpier. When it gets clumpy, it can annihilate then because the density is high enough that that can take place sometimes. That produces intermediate particles, which then can decay to things like gamma rays or to positrons and electrons. And then if we get lucky, these charged particles, antimatter, get trapped in the galactic halo, the magnetic field, and sometimes pass through Earth, and we can measure it with satellites. One example of this mission to measure this is the Pamela satellite, which I'm sure everybody's heard a little bit about. So Pamela had a very embarrassing set of data. This axis is the positrons that were detected by the satellite. This is the energy in GeV. So here's the data, and here's the black line that was supposed to fit it. So there are two problems here. The problem below around 9 GeV, actually, we do understand it has to do with solar modulation. Every 11 years, the sun goes through different solar cycles, and that changes the magnetic field. And so for these low-energy moving particles, that shifts the predictions of what you would expect. And when you apply this effect in its crudest form, you get that the data is right on the line. So there's no anomaly there. The other surprising and more interesting thing was that above around 10 GeV, you see that there's a steady climb and what the flux was measured, and this black line represents what you would have expected from all known astrophysical sources. Okay, so before I get in trouble, let me just say this is most likely something like unknown pulsars. I'm not explaining that this is a way with dark matter. However, what's nice about this from a dark matter perspective is it is sort of indicative of what you would expect for around 100 GeV or 200 GeV dark matter particle annihilating. You would expect some bump in the data, but the usual problem is that given that thermal constraint that I showed you on the background, that bump is just not large enough because these things don't annihilate efficiently enough. So if you instead go with this non-thermal thing and you push it as far as you can, you take that maximal case I told you, of course you can always fit data, but actually it was very difficult in the case of dark matter, especially if it's thermal. So this curve represents what you can do. So you can see you actually can get a bump that's inside the air lines. This again is for this Wino case, dominantly Wino case of dark matter. It goes through W bosons to positrons, so you can fit the data. So this is allowing me to do any curve fitting I want. Yes?
Your background looks different compared to the previous one. Is it just a different scale?
Oh, no. So when I say we're doing anything we want, so, okay, good question. There are lots of uncertainties in these astrophysical backgrounds. For example, the amount of diffuse starlight in the neighborhood is very difficult to measure. So what I'm saying I'm doing here is I'm taking all those astrophysical uncertainties, pushing them so we can explain the PML excess. So that's why I changed the background. So I'm changing all the astrophysical parameters in my favor. I'm in no way saying that we explain this, but anyway, I'm trying to prove a point.
Okay, but if you didn't take the background, you wouldn't have less signal.
That's right. Well, I'd be slightly short. But I'm going to criticize this, but go ahead.
Is there any kind of experiment that would go beyond this 100 GeV?
Well, not currently.
Not currently, but...
And these measurements are very difficult to make. But I don't want to dwell too much on this because... So the point is that pushing all the astrophysical uncertainties and all the theoretical uncertainties this way, we get something that maybe looks like...
So didn't Fermi go beyond 100 GeV?
Well, they did, but the data point is, there's not much data, so the confidence level is not enough to release the data point. But let me jump to the next slide. So instead, if you also ask what the same model would give you for antiprotons, this is the blue line, and you can see it's above the data, and so it's in excess. And so it's still within a standard acceptance level, but it's really overproducing the antiprotons. So the point is that you push this as far as you can, but the antiprotons are putting a very strong tension on what the observations are. So given this non-thermal history and taking the supersymmetric neutralino, you find out that you could try to use a WENO to explain Pamela, but there is a really strong tension, and there's a number of other experiments. The point I'm trying to make is that when you take all these experiments together, you can start ruling out these ideas even though you've pushed the astrophysical background as far as you can. That appeared in all these papers. But in particular, there's a new experiment, Fermi, which looks at gamma rays. Gamma rays doesn't suffer as much, at least in this way, from these astrophysical uncertainties. And so there, as the gamma rays come straight to us, if you take the structure of dark matter, one of the biggest uncertainties in the halo is how dark matter clumps. So if you take this clumping into effect, what you can find is you can put very strong constraints on this cross-section. So in particular, if you just take, this was work done with Pearl Sandick, this is our interaction cross-section. So remember, we're allowed to have larger cross-sections now because we allow this non-thermal scenario. If you take standard clumping, you get something like this. This dotted line corresponds to this WENO case I've been talking about. However, if you allow for dark matter to clump in spikes, which is something that we expect, if you apply that constraint, you find out that you can rule out all of this dark matter to this level. So this is more optimistic. The truth probably lies somewhere in between. But my point here is that as we understand the astrophysical uncertainties more, we can put strong constraints from indirect detection on a non-thermal history. Yeah.
Galaxies right now, looking at the Newtonian, 8 kilopascals. So we don't expect any dark matter, so it's made of very old. So this is maybe where this constraint is coming.
Well,
to do with the matter, the dark matter, the cusp problem, how to get rid of it.
Well, we did a number of constraints on this, even looking at external galaxies. So I think if we have clumpiness, this will be a strong constraint either way. But my main message here is just that indirect detection can be used to cut into these models, whereas, for example, for the very particular example I gave you, direct detection said nothing. But by going to indirect detection, I can start ruling this out. Furthermore, I want to switch gears completely. If I go to the CMB, if I do have this larger interaction cross-section with the dark matter will annihilate more efficiently. That means I'm going to pump more relativistic energy into the last scattering surface. So when I pump that more energy in, it means that last scattering takes longer. And when it takes longer, that means that the temperature correlations are less. And so by putting that constraint, you can rule out a lot of these cross-sections by WMAP. Then, if you look at, for example, the 200 GeV case I needed to try to explain Pamela, that corresponds to this point number 11. You can see that that's easily ruled out by Planck, unless Planck sees something funny going on. So by taking indirect detection, not so much in this case direct detection, CMB observations, and combining these into a coherent picture, we can really chop into this non-thermal history space. Yes?
So it's secure to fit the data, so you have a constraint on the, let's say, your WENO light mass. Because it's WENO light, that tells you how it annihilates. Then you also have to fit the cross section. And an effective cross section will be modulated by the Friese temperature. So it seems like you need a specific Friese temperature to make this work. So in this sense, you have a boost factor. And that boost factor, in this scenario,
yes,
will be proportional to curve.
Yeah, in fact, ours is 66.
Okay, but it seems like in the scenario you get a specific prediction for your reheat temperature.
Yeah, well, I mean, so you're going to have that reheat temperature was set to get the cross section to get the Pamela right, and then that, of course, once comes over here and does the same thing. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, no, you're right. I don't get too much in the details because I don't take this too seriously. I mean, I'm not saying we're explaining Pamela. My motivation is that we can use all these things to cut into this parameter space. Okay, so to answer your question about how you would test this, okay, so let's go to collider implications. All right, so we go to LHC, or hopefully another collider at some point, And we managed through luck to deduce, we can't measure dark matter particles, but we managed to deduce the cross-section. In the process, we assume that dark matter is thermal because we know that is the robust scenario. We plug this into that. We calculate the amount of dark matter that we expect cosmologically, and what we find is this answer is embarrassingly below the scale of WMAP. So what we expect the dark matter particle to be doesn't account for the cosmological observed dark matter. By the way, this would also be the case if there's more than one dark matter particle, but I'm not going to talk about that here. Instead, if we took this cross-section and plugged in the non-thermal history, we would get the right answer. So if we didn't know about this as being a consideration, we would ask, where is the missing dark matter? So that's an implication for colliders. I'm saying if that's what we measured, this when I times it by the velocity and take the thermal average, if that was what corresponded to what we deduced at LHC. So in other words, we deduced that the interaction cross-section of the particles is much larger than we had naively expected.
You mean for
Pamela? No Pamela here at all. I'm not talking about Pamela anymore. I'm just saying that if we don't allow cross-sections of this scale because we say that WMAP tells us that that's the cross-section of the dark matter particle. So by allowing another way that dark matter can be produced, that allows for changes in this cross-section that are viable. This does not at all depend on all the stuff I talked about before.
But what is the motivation for increasing sigma v to -3?
Well, in this non-thermal scenario, you can have anything from 10^-26 to 10^-23. This is the most extreme case.
But the motivation is Pamela, is that?
No. The motivation is that we can have a different phase in the early universe that's not entirely radiation dominated.
No, that's fine. So that's all a story. But the question is, do I have any reason to believe that story? And my understanding is that's one way to get more annihilation in indirect detection. Is that right?
No. So what I'm proposing is you have another cosmic phase instead of just a radiation-dominated universe prior to BBN. And the thing about Pamela was taking everything and pushing to explain it. I didn't have to do that. So for example, if I just take one of these models generically and calculate the indirect detection signal, it's going to be very small. And it won't, just like normal thermal dark matter.
Even though you have large cross-sections, you have 10^-23.
Yeah, even with 10^-23, remember, as David pointed out, this is confusing, I should have mentioned this. I'm taking all the ASTO parameters in my favor to push that signal as high as possible. And if you look at our papers, you'll see that in most cases, you're going to fall very much short. So in that sense, Pamela would put no constraint. But this certainly would. So the Pamela was an exercise just to show that you could try to say something about indirect detection. I hope that wasn't confusing. Okay, so in summary, what I'm saying is that if the early universe had this non-thermal history as opposed to a thermal history, the cross-section would vary between these scales. We've seen that in some of these experiments I mentioned, you could put tight constraints, and in fact, maybe 10^-23 is too high. That it's already in tension, it's in tension with Planck, and that's independent of what I said about Pamela. So 10^-24 might be possible. And of course, 10^-26 is possible, and it would just correspond to the thermal. We'd never know whether it was thermal or non-thermal, unless we worked with the fundamental theory. So there are lots of ways to test this very specific example I picked, which was I took MSSM, I took it to be a WENO, I didn't have to do that. I added one singlet, and this is just the first example where we ran through all the ways that you might try to combine data to try to test these different ideas. Okay, so one question I had anticipated that nobody asked me about is if during this decay you dilute dark matter, don't you also dilute the baryon asymmetry? Okay, that is problematic. And if you're looking at standard, for example, gut baryon baryogenesis, that would be problematic. Remember that once this dilution, the non-thermal decay takes place, I dilute whatever I had by this factor of the freeze-out to the reheat temperature. However, if I focus on models of afflux-dyne baryogenesis, which is very similar to the scalar condensate that I talked about forming to give us this non-thermal phase, afflux-dyne baryogenesis is basically a similar story, except the scalar just carries baryon number. And this is actually a very promising way to get baryogenesis in the early universe. However, typically when you calculate how much baryon asymmetry you get, this afflux-dyne baryogenesis is typically too effective. The amount of baryon asymmetry you get is usually too large. So what happens is when you have this decay of this scalar field, it actually dilutes this to the point where you can get a reasonable amount of baryonic symmetry. That is to say, where the ratio of baryons to photons is about 10 to the minus 10. If you work out the numbers in a hand-waving argument, what you get is that this reheat temperature would be slightly above BBN, which is what we talked about. The mass of the scalar field would be around the TeV scale, which is what we talked about. And then there's this factor of the misalignment between the two vacua, which is more of a technical point. But you can see I haven't introduced any very large numbers to explain the origin of this baryonic symmetry. It's a little bit messy, but it is a possibility. But what's interesting and makes this more compelling is when you do this calculation, what you find out is you can address something that's often called the cosmic coincidence problem, which is why some people worry about why the amount of baryons in the late universe is very close to the amount of dark matter. That didn't have to be the case. It's not the case in dark energy. So why are these numbers so similar, even though they're supposed to come from entirely different processes? Dark matter is supposed to be thermally froze out. Baryonic symmetry comes from baryogenesis. So why are these numbers related? And what we find out is if you have the Saffling-Dyne mechanism and you have the dilution for the moduli decay, you actually get, or the scalar decay, you actually get a relationship between the amount of baryons and the amount of dark matter. I just wanted to mention that briefly. Yeah.
What's the final direction?
So it's basically the initial displacement of the scalar field that's responsible for baryogenesis compared to the one that's responsible for the non-thermal phase.
Okay.
Which I'll try to say more about in a minute. But so details on this are in this paper. Okay, so the big point of everything I was saying is that other cosmic histories are possible. I only talked about this idea of a non-thermal history. You might imagine other histories. In fact, we already heard one where you don't necessarily have decay, but you have matter domination would affect the way that dark matter is produced. We've seen that the way that dark matter is produced definitely determines its microscopic properties. And so now I want to return to the question about the microphysical setup that we have. So in particular, we wanted to have an unstable particle, which we called phi. I said it had to be gravitationally coupled. And we said that the symmetry breaking had to give rise ultimately to its mass. And that's all the ingredients we needed for the non-thermal scenario that I talked about. Now, you could take that as a phenomenological scenario. Hopefully, I've convinced you it's a robust thing that we should consider. And it would affect experimental results. However, our initial motivation for looking at this actually came from theory. So as everybody knows, new fields are a generic prediction of physics beyond the standard model, in particular scalar fields. Sometimes these have geometric interpretation, for example, the size of extra dimensions or the distance between brains and Randall syndrome setups. Alternatively, more on the model building level, we know that there's scalar partners to the standard model fermions and supersymmetric theories, and these lead to flat directions that can be parameterized by scalar fields. In string-based setups to trying to do phenomenology, we find out that all of our low energy couplings in the standard model Lagrangian should in principle be given by vacuum expectation values of these scalar fields. But generically in all of these setups, what we have is that there's many scalar fields that can be present. And if these are not stabilized and there's no forces acting on them, generically during cosmological phase transitions like reheating, these fields would be displaced. And that's what I mean by this term moduli in this talk. So there are two questions that we need to answer in regards to whether this non-thermal scenario would be motivated by fundamental theory. The first one is, can we actually form these condensates that I talked about that gave rise to this matter-dominated phase? And if so, we had this mass range. So that range on the cross-section really translated into a mass range, which I'm taking this a little high, but this mass range. And we want to ask, what should we expect for the mass of this scalar field? So those are the two questions I want to answer quickly. So the first is, do these condensates actually form? In other words, do fields get displaced? Are there forces stabilizing them? So this is a one-slide summary of progress on trying to understand this question. So over the years, especially in string-based ideas, we know that by including additional degrees of freedom that appear in these fundamental theories, for example, string theory or supergravity, these generate stabilizing potentials for many of these scalar fields. And so in particular, the mass of these scalar fields would be set by a string scale or something near the Planck scale. They become massive, they decouple from the low energy physics, and you don't necessarily care about them. That's probably familiar to many people in this room. Something that's a little less familiar is that even without a stabilizing potential, if these scalar fields are located near points of enhanced symmetries, then what Dine, Randall, and Thomas argued is that these, once at one of these points of enhanced symmetries, they would stay at these points. So these scalar fields would not get displaced through these phase transitions. And it has to do with being protected by gauge symmetries, but I won't say much about that. What this becomes is a problem of why would you find these scalar fields at these points to begin with. And so there's been a lot of work on that where it's been shown that these are actually attractive in the early universe. They act as attractors to the cosmological evolution. So let me give you a quick picture of how that works. So this is it's hard to see, but this is a slice in field space. So this is a, say, phi direction and a chi direction. Initially, I would start out on some branch. And as I move into this point in the center, this represents our point of enhanced symmetry. So we have more symmetry at this point in the center. So there are two interesting properties of this. The first is that in most of these setups, especially if they're based in string theories, the geometry of this field space is actually hyperbolic. And what that tells you, if you examine the dynamics, is that if you look at the phase space of this field, you will randomly sample all of these locations in finite time. So that means eventually you are guaranteed to pass through one of these enhanced symmetry points. So the question is, what happens as you approach this? And there are two effects. One is if the theory you're looking at happens to be a strong coupling, then as I approach this point, there's going to be a friction-like effect that can trap me at this enhanced symmetry point, or ESP. The other point of view is if you have a weak coupled theory, as I pass through one of these points, I can actually have a particle production effect of this other species. So for example, if I'm out on this branch, this chi field would have a large mass. As I pass through here, it becomes massless. And as I try to leave this point, this creates a stabilizing potential that traps this particle and generates a potential for it at this minimum. And so that was done in a lot of papers. The important point for my talk will be, so that stabilized a lot of these scalar fields that were forced to consider when we worked in fundamental theories. But what we find out is when we look at these examples, and this is work with Sarah Cremonini some time ago, was that there always seems to be one scalar field that cannot be stabilized. And this has been borne out in many other examples over the years. And this is actually a consequence of arranging for hierarchies from, for example, string compactifications. As a very simple example, if I just look at something like dimensional transmutation, where I take large scalar field BEVs to generate a hierarchy in scales, that requires me to be away from the origin of the space, and there is typically no enhanced symmetries. So it's more of a technical point. The take-home message for this is that when we study these models in detail, we find out that there's one light scalar field that typically remains, at least. So that's our scalar field, and we do expect that it would form some condensate. Okay, so before I turn to the other question, are there any questions?
Is it light compared to what?
By light, I mean it would be the Suzy breaking scale. So TeV scale. But I'll run through examples that you'll like better in a minute. Or not like, I'm not sure. But okay. So this is your question, I guess. What masses should we expect for these light scalar fields? Okay, so an old argument goes as follows. So let me focus on supergravity theory. So we have supersymmetry, extension of the standard model. We know gravity's around. We need this theory to be consistent. Therefore, it's supergravity in the early universe. The scalar potential can be written in terms of this function k and this function w, whose details won't be that important. The important point is that the statement I made earlier about the scalar field being light can correspond, for example, to a shift symmetry. The shift symmetry in supersymmetric theories, these scalars come as complex pairs. And so you can have an axion symmetry, and that will forbid this scalar field from appearing in this potential, at least perturbatively. So what was needed to try, we have three things we need to do. We need to stabilize the scalar field. That will have to be done non-perturbatively. We need to break supersymmetry, because as it stands, this theory would be supersymmetric. And when we do that supersymmetry breaking, we need to have an almost cancellation of these two terms in order to get the cosmological constant to be very small today. Because after all, when we stabilize these scalar fields, their value in the minimum will correspond to the cosmological constant. So accounting for these hierarchies, what we have to do is introduce something that will depend parametrically on the ratio of phi to the Planck scale. And what that means is that we add something to the potential to accomplish these three things, and that will set the mass of the scalar field around the scale of the gravitino mass, which is around the TeV scale. So this is something you generically expect. And in fact, this had a name. It was called the Polony problem in the days of supergravity. And in this more of the string regime, it's called the cosmological moduli problem. It's viewed as a problem because if this field was around the TeV scale, we would enter that problem with BBN and screw up the light elements. However, we've seen that if it's a 10 TeV or above, this is actually exactly what we needed for the non-thermal scenario. So what's a little bit surprising, again, I said this is an old result. What's a little newer is the fact that there's a more general result that even if the scalar doesn't participate in the supersymmetry breaking, the claim is that if I arrange for a small cosmological constant and I ensure that the mass of the electroweak scale is far below the Planck scale, I will still get this result. And that was not at all anticipated. So quickly, I started late, right? Let me run through quickly an example from string theory. It doesn't have to be string theory, but this is one of the most well-studied cases, and I'll focus on type 2B flux compactifications. The point of this, if you don't care about these details, is that this scalar did not actually have to contribute to the supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so the first step is we saw that including all these ingredients like gauge fields and brains, this stabilizes the scalar fields. It gives them large masses. In particular, in the setup, this stabilizes all the complex structure moduli and the dilaton. So these get really large scalar fields, less than number one. These decouple from the low energy theory, but they generate a constant in the superpotential, or that leads to a constant in the potential. This breaks supersymmetry. And so this not ignoring the stabilization of these scalar fields, even though they have no dynamic effect, tells me that supersymmetry is broken and I have to do something to fix it. So I turn to step two. So now what I want to do is introduce some Gugino condensation, which is this term that enters this potential. This could be generated by non-perturbative effects, much like in QCD. It could also be some more stringy effects with wrapped brains. The point is that when I add this contribution, it can restore supersymmetry. But in order for this eventually to give us a model that will have the electroweak hierarchy built into it, I'm going to have to tune either the amount of flux that I use to stabilize these moduli or scalar fields, or I'm going to have to play with the size of the compactified dimensions, because here we're working in 10 dimensions. So the lesson here is to accommodate the electroweak scale, I'm going to have to either tune fluxes or I'm going to have to tune the volume of the extra dimensions. Okay, so that arranges for the electroweak hierarchy. Again, I told you I'm not solving the hierarchy problem, but this accounts for it by these tunings, and you can argue about whether that's natural or not. At this point, we have a supersymmetric theory. We're in an ADS minimum. We have a four-dimensional world that we're living in, and this off this direction is 10-dimensional Minkowski space. The final step is that we need to get the cosmological constant right. We don't live in anti-de Sitter space, it turns out. So if we take this potential and we lift it up, we arrange for its value to be 10 to the minus 120. So we account for the cosmological constant. Again, I'm not solving that problem. I'm just arranging for it. This can be done in two ways, or at least two ways. One is by adding an anti-D3 brain, whatever that means, and raises this up to give us dark energy. Alternatively, you can take a phenomenological approach and you can add chiral matter, which was done by Nielis et al. And that arranges for the hierarchy in the cosmological constant. And so we have this barrier and ability to keep away from 10 dimensions. Okay, so what else do I need to tell you? The key point for what I'm talking about here is when you calculate what the vacuum expectation value of the scalar field will be, that's what we've been after. In other words, where it's stabilized at its minimum, you can do the calculation and you find out it depends on the ratio of the Planck scale to the gravitino mass, or in other words, the electroweak hierarchy again. That comes in as a log power. And so what you find is, if you go through all the details, is that the mass of the scalar field is determined by this VEV times the gravitino mass. The gravitino mass should be on the TeV scale in order to get electroweak symmetry breaking right and natural, preserve the hierarchy that you tuned. And therefore, this predicts a scalar field in these models that's 100 times a TeV, which is in that range that we were looking for to predict the non-thermal history. There are details about this uplifted de Sitter, but I'm going to skip over these. when we did this case in the type 2b configurations, we lost this nice result that you can take some high scale, you form some condensate, and it can generate a low scale. I just want to briefly mention that if you try to work instead with G2 manifolds or another set of compactifications, and you try to stabilize all these scalar fields there, this can be done without fluxes in principle. And so that would mean you would not introduce this overall constant I had to tune, and you could hope that this gives you some way to, again, get this electroweak hierarchy out naturally, but that remains work in progress. The upshot is, though, in the way it's currently realized, this again gives you a mass around 100 TeV. Quickly, a few more examples. If I look at F-theory constructions, as Heckman and Vaffa et al. Have done, I get the same result. If I look at flux, warped compactifications, and even in the absence of supersymmetry, there are good reasons to believe that, again, you will have some mass of scalar fields that will depend on the geometry, and that will be related to the gravitino mass in the following way. So what I hope you're getting from this, if you're not already familiar with these things, is that if I work in consistent supersymmetry plus gravity constructions, what I find out is that a non-thermal history is naturally predicted by accounting for these hierarchies. If I arrange in these setups, which are very restrictive, to get the electroweak hierarchy and the cosmological constant, don't explain it, just get them, then I naturally get this scalar field in the range for a non-thermal history as opposed to a thermal history. And so that's the theoretical argument I wanted to make. So I'm completely out of time. I'll skip over the comments and caveats. So more on the larger scale, putting aside the string compactifications and supergravity, what I hope I've shown you is that besides the well-motivated thermal scenario that we should consider, we do expect new symmetries beyond the standard model. We expect stable particles charged under those symmetries. We expect extra stuff, not just enough to explain the Higgs mass, but it comes with other junk that we have to deal for, whether you like Randall syndrome or you like string theory or like whatever your favorite model is. If those particles are unstable, if they're gravitationally coupled, which they always have to at least be, and if their mass is generated by breaking these symmetries, which is a natural expectation, then we're going to get these TeV scale mass particles if we account for the electroweak hierarchy and the cosmological constant problem in the string cases I talked about. So last slide. I started by asking how is dark matter produced and what are its microscopic properties. What we've seen is that if we want a complete answer and a convincing answer, this requires combining collider, direct, and indirect detection experiments with cosmological probes along with guidance from fundamental theory. We can't do it with one single component of this list. In the case of the non-thermal scenario, these findings suggest that there are new possibilities for cosmic history prior to BBN. And so in some cases, these are motivated by fundamental theory and that they can be scrutinized. In the case of the very specific WINO example I gave you, it could perhaps even be ruled out by current and near-term observations. Thank you.
I think there was a question, I'm not sure you went back to it, but what about the gravitational problem?
Yeah. So.
Does that influence the displacement of
pi? So just as a proof of principle. So it's model dependent, of course. So one of the problems is when the scalar decays, it could decay to gravitinos, and those can overclose the universe or cause disasters. So in some models that we've looked at, the idea is that the mass of this field is less than twice the gravitino mass, so it's just kinetically or kinematically forbidden. There are other arguments due to Dine et al. Of chirality about how you can have these decay or not, but it is an extremely model-dependent question, and I don't have any robust answer for that. Another thing that I'll anticipate is I also only talked about gravity mediation. You could also talk about gauge mediation. There was a recent paper by Leon Tao, Wang, and Gigi Fan, and there they consider gauge mediation, and that's another, there the scale is going to be slightly lower than what I'm saying. The masses could be higher or lower, and so it again becomes somewhat model-dependent. Gauge mediation is something that has not been looked at as well as what I've been talking about. Of course, there the gravitino is the dark matter, so it's.
When you start getting results for one ton xenon, transition, you get down to cross sections, 10⁻⁷ cm², and they still see nothing how does this affect you?
Well, so
this is a hypothetical question.
Yes. So if I were my collaborator, I would say, who will remain nameless, that, well, that means you have proof of a Wino neutralino because it doesn't interact up to the conversation we're going to have. However, what I would just say is that it doesn't tell you anything. You need to look at the other experiments. And what you really need to do is work in a fundamental theory where you're calculating this stuff, and then you can see what's your prediction for this, indirect detection, cosmology, and put them all together as a coherent picture.
So how do you ultimately falsify
all of this? No, well, I just showed you a way. So if I had a pure Wino trying to explain Pamela, it's ruled out. And I think this is one of my favorite ways to rule it out.
Or verify it. Positive.
So here's one way to rule it out. If I have, for example, this is the cross section of the particles I'm looking at. The non-thermal, at least for the above 10 to the minus 26 case, appears on this graph. So if my dark matter was, say, 100 GeV, and I know from this non-thermal scenario the cross section is 10 to the minus, say, 24, it's already ruled out by WMAP. And as we improve, for example, the Planck observations, this will cut down into this space a lot. Now, the big question you could ask me is if non-thermal gives you 10 to the minus 26, how do you distinguish that between thermal? That would be complicated.
Other questions? No? Okay, what's the next study?